Riyadh is in the autofill of my phone now, so I'm excited about that.
Yes.
I just type DEL and it pops up. Like, thank God. I was going to put a quote up about Robert Jordan. I was like, you know what? I'm going to leave him and let Joe do it because he's going to come up with something much better than I do.
And oh, I don't know. I just saw it and put it there.
No, but you have, like, you know, you put all the actual Wheel of Time stuff into it. That was good. Mm. Is there a way to make this, like, the way Joe's is?
Can you do that, Dan?
Can you do it like Joe?
Can you do it like Joe? Can you do it like Joe, Dan? Can you raise her gain? We are grown-ups.
We are.
Oh, check.
That's better.
That's a little.
Hey,
better.
I can see her now.
Yeah.
Hey.
How's that?
Here I am.
Hey, I like that.
Is it better?
It's better.
It's still much smaller than everybody else's.
I know. check. Oh, that's good.
That's really good.
That's
you
got to
keep it up. Keep up the energy.
Hello, I'm Jen Isbro, and welcome to Talk Around Riyadh, the Wheel of Time showcase.
There you go.
I'll practice this for the day when Joe can't be here.
No. We should give Dan credits as a sound engineer.
He's part of the crack team. I like it.
Okay. All right. Here we go. We're going to start this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Welcome to Talk Around Riyadh, the Wheel of Time showcast. I am Joe Perry, and I'm here with my co-host, Jen Isgro. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Joe.
And I'm also here with my other co-host, Tom Kokoza. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Joe. Excited today.
Yes. So today we're going to be doing part two of our Talaran Riyadh series. But before we get into that, we found out some exciting news today.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was just today. So we thought we were going to be talking about Talaran Riyadh for the whole episode, but we do have some news. So on Instagram, the Dusty Wheel, some of you might know the Dusty Wheel, they do a weekly YouTube kind of like adaptation of what they think the episodes of the Wheel of Time Eye of the World are going to be. And Dusty Wheel had posted an article on Instagram on some website called Redanian Intelligence, which apparently is dedicated to The Witcher coming on Netflix. But they had some casting news. There's three new castings that were confirmed. So Abel and Natty Cawthon, Matt's parents, have been cast. Actors Christopher Shureff, and I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, is going to be playing Abel Cawthon, and Juliet Howland will be playing Natty Cawthon. I think, and I went back and watched the video, the table read video, and I think Juliet Howland was at the table. She might have been the person sitting next to the who we confirmed as Johan Myers with the glasses, but it was too hard to confirm. They look similar, but I'm not really positive about that one.
Yeah, I've been talking to the guys down at the labs, and the enhance function is not working on the computers the way that they expect it to, so we're still waiting on solid confirmation on that, Joe, but I believe you are correct. There's definitely a resemblance.
Yes. Christopher Shureff, if that's his name, he's been in a lot of TV shows. He was on that miniseries Sons of Liberty. He was in Exodus Gods and Kings. He was in Rome, the HBO, all bit parts. Some of them, he doesn't even really have character names. But he's done a lot of work. He does a voice in Assassin's Creed, the game, a few of the games. I imagine it's the same character. And Juliet Howland has also been in a lot of television, you know, shows here and there. Nothing really I know too well. It seems like a lot of British television. She was on Agatha Christie's Poirot. She was on that TV show for an episode, Skins, the one that it was originally a British a TV show that became like an American show. Who was also on Skins?
No.
The girl from Game of Thrones. I can't remember her name. The one with Sam. The one with the baby. She was one of Craster's wives, daughters. Wives.
Gilly?
Gilly, yes. She was on that show too, Skins. Oh, and she was also in V for Vendetta. She's credited as middle class mum.
Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember her. But so that's two new confirmed castings, which is exciting. So we know Abel and Natty are confirmed to be in the show. I imagine they'll be in at least one episode.
Right.
And then the other casting was an actress named Helena Westerman. So I did recognize her face, and when I went back and watched the video, she is the woman or girl sitting next to Marcus Rutter. Definitely. I could tell. I saw it, and it was definitely her. I could tell. And she is being cast as somebody named Layla Ibarra, which is not an actual character in the book, but she appears to be an Ibarra by the last name. So I'm not really sure who she's going to be.
We didn't need the crack researchers for that one.
No, that one I figured out all on my own. So we're not sure how she's related to Perrin, because Perrin does have three siblings, two sisters, Adora and Dicelle. So she's not either one of them, I guess. I don't know if she's going to be a sister and they just changed the name, or she's going to be some sort of other relation to Perrin. Yeah. So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming she's a sister. She looks youngish. She looks of an age to be a sibling, but I don't know. You know, there's that.
Maybe they're. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Maybe they're adding him to having a sister the way, like, of an age with Matt's sister, and they're maybe she'll be with all those girls just to give him like more of a connection.
Yeah, I think you're right. They definitely have to humanize the Ibarras for when they get murdered later on.
Exactly.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Because you never meet them in the books, but they wind up getting murdered. So I think you'd want to play that up where you get kind of, you know, some sort of relationship attachment to them where, you know, when they get murdered, it's much more dramatic, you know, than in the books. But those are all, that's our casting news. So that's pretty exciting that we do have some more casting. Not exactly what we were looking for. We're still, you know, still waiting for Tam and Tom and confirmation on those, but it's something. She also is not as well acted as the other two. Her only acting credit was in a short called Quota. So, yeah. So she's a newbie to acting.
Well, she's done the minimum requirement. You know,
yes. She might have been doing stage acting. We don't know. I didn't really.
Filled her quota, if you will.
Yes. Oh. Yes.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Yes.
All right, and I am done for tonight's recording. Yes. I apologize.
Her IMDb bio simply states: Helena Westerman is an actress known for quota.
See.
This is her big break.
This is going to be her big break. Unfortunately, she's not really going to be in much, but maybe they'll...
You never know.
That's true. That's true. We never know. So let's continue on then. Let's get back into it. Teleran Riyadh, right? Last week, we talked about basically what is Teleran Riyadh, how does it work, and kind of the ins and outs of it. There is one correction that I did want to make from last week. We did kind of hover back and forth between dreamwalking being related to channeling, and I was able to find out, you know, well, I shouldn't claim the credit. It was our research team did confirm that there are dreamwalkers who are not channelers, specifically two of the IEL wise ones, Bear, who we should have known right away because she's a pretty prominent character. And then Sienna, who is another wise one who I believe dies in the Shadow Rising. I think it's the Shadow Rising when they get attacked by the Trollocs.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Or it could be Fires of Heaven. I'm not sure. Right? They're still in the Waste and Fires of Heaven, right? Don't they come back?
Yeah, they leave the Waste and Fires of Heaven.
So it might be Fires of Heaven. Anyway, so it is confirmed that dreamwalking is not related to channeling necessarily. So with that, let's get back into it. All right. So this episode, we're going to get into the dreams and talk about the dream sequences that are in Eye of the World. We're going to go through each one of them. We're going to read some excerpts so everyone get excited. We're going to do some reading and then kind of break each one down and see where it takes us. So the first dream that we have is in Chapter 9, Tellings of the Wheel. So I think, Jen, you are going to start us off with that first dream.
I am. So this dream takes place after Winter Night. So it starts off with Rand running through a barren field. There's no plant life really growing there. He says the sun looks like it should be very hot, but it's very cold. There's no wind. Well, actually, let me look for a second. It's cold, but there's no wind. Yeah, that's correct. The air burned cold. All right. I thought I was getting something wrong there. Trollocs are chasing after him. He comes up to a cliff, a 1,000-foot cliff, and he thinks they're going to catch up to him. And then he looks down. There's a valley with fog that is glowing red as if fire is underneath it. So then I'm going to read the next paragraph here. It was not the valley itself that sapped his strength and filled the empty spaces left with helplessness. From the center of the furious vapors, a mountain thrust upward, a mountain taller than any he had ever seen in the mountains of mist, a mountain as black as the loss of all hope. That bleak stone spire, a dagger stabbing at the heavens, was the source of his desolation. He had never seen it before, but he knew it. The memory of it flashed away like quicksilver when he tried to touch it, but the memory was there. He knew it was there.
I want to stop you there because I want to talk
stop
about that.
Stop me right here. All right.
You've so done that, Joe. I stopped you.
So that's Sheol Ghul, right? It's got to be, right? Are we in agreement for that one?
Yeah,
I think that it is. I do think that there might be like an intended bit of uncertainty about whether it's Dragon Mount or not, because you don't know at this point. You don't know at this point, like everyone considers a dragon evil. And so they may want, like, there's a lot in the first couple of books about playing with, like, what's evil and what's not, but it's Sheol Ghul.
Right, because we actually, when Jen continues on, we're actually going to, they're actually, Dragon Mount is also in the stream.
Yep.
One other thing, too, I wanted to point out, and I love rereading this because there's things in this that you never noticed before. So that line Jen mentioned, the memory of it flashed away like quicksilver when he tried to touch it, but the memory was there. He knew it was there. So is this our first confirmed memory of Luz Theron?
Yeah,
I think so.
I think it's literally that early.
That's
right?
Crazy, right? In the literally chapter 9, we're already getting memories.
Yeah, because nothing else happened to him before Winter Night that would... Everything, I think, was normal before that, right?
Yeah.
I think so.
For him.
Yeah.
Before the first Trolloc appeared.
Great. I love it. All right. Go ahead, John.
Okay. So something now is trying to draw him to the mountain, and he's almost ready to go. He's giving up. And then he starts feeling angry that he's kind of being prodded and pushed where he doesn't want to be going. So now he's clinging to his anger. He's not going to go. And he hears a voice whispering, "Serve me." He's trying to get the voice out of his head. And it says he shakes his fist at the Black Mountain. "The light consume you, Shaitan."
Okay, I'm going to stop you. I'm sorry. I'm going to keep doing that. I'm sorry. I'm going to keep interrupting.
All right, you can interrupt me.
So who do you guys think serve me is saying? Who's saying serve me? Who's whispering that voice? Do you guys have any ideas?
I don't know. I think it's Baal-Zamon by the next paragraph.
Okay, I think so too. Because at first I thought it might be the Dark One, but I think every time the Dark One speaks, it's always in caps, right? All caps.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, this is in just italics because it's in his voice in his head.
Yeah, okay. I think it's. I think all of it is Baal-Zamon here. I think he's got what he considers a pretty strong playbook of warping people into his service, and this is right out of that. So he's, I think that this is a Baal-Zamon only tactic.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure. Because I imagine the only reason I ask is because I know there's a lot of things in the first couple of books where you think that maybe Robert Jordan didn't fully flesh out yet and wasn't sure about. So I didn't know if this was maybe, it could have been the Dark One. He just decided later on that he was going to make the Dark One all caps. So just wanted to get your guys' impressions on that one.
No, but while we stomped here, I want to say that this is, I think, the first Rand in the first book, for most of the first book, is pretty much a character who doesn't have a lot of strong personality traits, right? And I think that's on purpose, you know, to kind of help you identify with the character, right? You know, but this is like the first real. The one personality trait that he does have that I think is strong in that book is a rock-hard, stubborn streak where he will not be pushed to do things he doesn't want to do. And if you try and push him, he'll like double down on not doing it, which is a problem that Moraine has with him that takes her a long time to figure out how to deal with him on. But this is like the first real instance of that being seen like in his dream. Like he's like, you know what? I know I'm near death, but F this. I'm not going to do what they're trying to get me to do.
That Two Rivers stubbornness, right? That they always talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can go, Jen.
Okay, I will. Okay, so I'm going to read this next paragraph. "Abruptly, the smell of death lay thick around him. A figure loomed over him in a cloak the color of dried blood, a figure with a face. He did not want to see the face that looked down at him. He did not want to think of that face. It hurt to think of it, turned his mind to embers. A hand reached toward him. Not caring if he fell over the edge, he threw himself away. He had to get away, far away. He fell, flailing at the air, wanting to scream, finding no breath for screaming, no breath at all." Okay, then he falls, but he lands Oh, no, I'm sorry. He doesn't fall. He stops falling. He's standing up in a plain with trees and grass. And now he sees in the distance reared a single mountain, its peak broken and split. But this mountain brought no fear or despair. It was just a mountain, though oddly out of place there with no other in sight, which I think we've already established as Dragomount. A broad river flowed by the mountain, and on an island in the middle of that river was a city such as might live in a gleeman's tale, a city surrounded by high walls gleaming white and silver beneath the warm sun. With mingled relief and joy, he started for the walls, for the safety and serenity he somehow knew he would find behind them.
So that's Tar-Valon. That's how we know, right? That's Dragomount, the river, and then that's Tar-Valon. So I didn't realize the first time we actually see Tar-Valon is in the dream.
Yes. Yeah. He's seen a couple of times in his dreams, right? I would take a pause right here. Is that how we're saying it? Tar-Valon?
I say Tar-Valon.
How do you say it?
I say Tar-Valon because I pronounce it as close to Avalon. Avalon is possible since that's what it's like. That's where it's from. You know, like from, it's the place that Arthur goes when he dies.
So you know what? I used to say Tar-Valon as well, and for some reason, I thought I was corrected, and it's Tar-Valon. But maybe you're right.
It may be. I never looked it up. There's certain words and phrases that you know, you don't really have a strong handle on, so you look up to find out how you say them. This one I never did. I just like, oh, okay, this is very Arthurian, very much like Avalon. I'm just going to say Tar-Valon and go like that. But
oh, no, you're right. It is Tar-Valon. No, it's Tar-Valon. Oh. The accent's on the first syllable, Valon.
Okay.
Tar-Valon. Oh, you're right, Jenna. It's Valon, technically.
I say Tar-Valon.
Yeah, it is. It's Tar-Valon.
I don't know why, but...
Okay.
The second syllable is not accented.
Let's lock it in.
Because I used to say Tar-Valon also, Tom, all the time, and then I was corrected at some point and changed it.
Maybe it's in the back of the book.
It is. That's what I'm looking at.
Where I got it from. Okay.
That's what I'm looking at. Yeah, it's Tar-Valon.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So then he's walking towards the city. He's describing the city bridges and the lacy stonework on the delicate bridges. And... So he feels someone behind him. He feels a coldness over his body. He's running. It's basically Balzamon. He feels like freezing fingers on him, trying to pull him back. He's running towards the city, but he can't get there. It keeps getting farther and farther away. He continues to run. He trips and falls, and then he lands on the paving stones right outside the city. He gets up. There's a lot of people on either side of him. And they're talking to him, but he can't understand what they're saying. But they're all friendly, and they're kind of gesturing him and leading him onward into the city. So he follows them. He's just describing how beautiful the city is. He's never seen anything like it. And there's music, and everything's amazing and great. And, okay, now he's in the city, and he sees a tower. And he feels like that's where he has to go. That's where the knowledge he seeks is in that tower. So he says first he's going to go around the city before he goes there. Then I have, so he turns on aside from the tower. Ahead of him down the street was a snow-white tower, the same tower. In just a little while, he thought, and rounded another corner. At the far end of this street, too, lay the white tower. Stubbornly, he turned another corner, and another, and each time the alabaster tower met his eyes. He spun to run away from it and skidded to a halt. Before him, the white tower. He was afraid to look over his shoulder, afraid it would be there, too. So now the people around him are kind of losing hope. They're kind of pleading with him to go to the tower. And he decides, okay, I was going to go there anyway, so I'll go. And as soon as he starts walking, everyone's happy again, and they're dancing around him. They're singing to him. They're putting flowers around his neck. Everything's amazing. He hears a voice whispering, "It is your destiny." And he kind of follows the crowd up the stairs of the tower, and the very end of the dream is scrollwork covered the massive doors at the top of the stairs, carving so intricate and delicate that he could not imagine a knife blade fine enough to fit. The portal swung open, and he went in. They closed behind him with an echoing crash like thunder. "We have been waiting for you," the Murdral hissed.
Oh, chilling.
The end. He sat bolt upright. The end.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Everywhere he turns is the tower.
So...
literally.
We were talking, Jen, before about how I didn't think this was a dream shard, but now I do think it's a dream shard again, because I think this is all like a setup by Balzamon to kind of
try and make him not want to go there.
Yeah, I think so. I think because we'll get into the other dreams where he does talk about the tower more. But yeah, now I think it's almost like it's not the traditional dream shard that we're going to see in the next dream, but it's more of like Balzamon's playing with his mind, trying to keep himself hidden and forcing him to go to the tower and then putting that horrible ending out there for him to try to keep him from going to the White Tower because he doesn't want the tower getting involved.
Was there a Murdral that had to have been before this? Does he see any Murdral?
He sees the Black Rider, remember, in the very beginning, first chapter?
Okay.
Yeah. But
oh, that's right. Okay.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, Joe. This is a, in modern parlance, a disinformation campaign, right? He is deliberately trying to taint any part of the impression, but he's trying to color any impression of safety or any feeling of safety that Ram may have by going to the White Tower, by tying them in with the Dark One. And trying to make Rand think that they're just as evil in a different way. And he's trying to like subtly do that. So he's not tying it, you know, he's not being present there. He's present in the beginning. This is evil. Run away. Oh, you can go here for safety. No, you can't. They're evil too. And like, that's his play. His play is to make these boys so desperate that they feel there is no other option and they break and they allow the shadow into them. Themselves. Like, so there's different, they talk about this later on, right? There's different ways, I guess, that people turn to the shadow, and some are out of, you know, a lust for power or desire to just commit evil, but some feel like hopelessness and they feel they can't win. And so they might as well just succumb. And that's what he's hoping to do to them here.
Yeah. And you're right. It is a theme throughout. When we go through the other dreams, there's constantly...
It's a dream theme.
Yeah, it's a dream theme, exactly. The dream theme. Yeah, we're constantly seeing the tower appear or Balzamon talking about Aes Sedai, and we're going to see it in the other dreams we go through. So it's definitely something that's reappears in the, at least in the Eye of the World. And yeah, I just realized that, yeah, I was thinking this wasn't a dream shard because it's different than the other dreams, but then I was like, oh, it is a dream shard. It's just, like you said, it's like kind of almost like a subtle propaganda.
Right. And also, I mean, it kind of has to be because, like, Rand's, you know, ancestral soul memories through Luthaeron or whatever may know what Sheol Gul looks like. It has no idea what Tar Valon, I'll get it right one day, what that city looks like, because that did not come until after Luthaeron mounted himself.
Yeah, and that's how we definitely know that he's in Teleran Riad, because he doesn't know what Tar Valon looks like. He doesn't know what Dragomount or Sheol Gul looks like, and it's for him to dream it. I guess you would have to say that his memories, Luthaeron's memories, would be in his head a lot more. But I don't think we're really that far into it.
No,
because he doesn't really start getting really into those memories until what, Fires of Heaven?
Really until. Yeah, Fires Lord of Heaven, Lord of Chaos is when it really starts. That's when he starts talking back.
Yes.
And that's the end. That's the end of Sane Rand.
Yes, for a while. Just for a while.
Yeah, for six books.
All right, anyone before else? Go ahead.
Before we move on, let's just quickly discuss what our Twitter follower, Tamerlin at Theoryland, had to say about this particular dream.
Oh yeah, that's right. So we did post on Twitter that we were recording this episode and asked if anyone wanted to give us any feedback or any questions or anything, something we wanted to talk about. And Tamerlin did post a theory, as Tamerlin is known to do. So I'll read the quote. New theory, dream or prophetic talent shared by individuals, they pull into their dream shards. And that would explain the more dreamer-like elements in Rand's experience in the chapter, while still maintaining dream shard explanations, taking into account that Rand is not a dreamer. So I guess I want to discuss, I never really thought about Rand being a dreamer. I mean, we know he's a dreamwalker, because he goes into Teleran or Riad many times, I think on his own, not just necessarily being pulled into dream shards. But I never really thought about him being a dreamer at all. So is this an explanation? Because this would assume then that Ishmael's a dreamer, right?
Yes, I think that's the assumption, which I think people have made that connection in the past. That's why he has like sort of a sense of how things are going to go. It's not just a fact that he's been alive on and off for eons, but like that he has a general sense of prophecy. But I think it's an interesting theory. I don't know if Rand is dreaming here, with a capital D, like Egwene does, and seeing his future per se, or seeing anything prophetic. I think again that this is really more of Ishmael Balzamon's like very very pinpointed attempt to present him with something that's going to screw with his expectations.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's really a construct of Balzamon's dream shard. And we're going to go into a dream with Perrin, and I think it's hard really to go by Perrin's dreams because he's a totally different kind of dreamer.
Yeah.
But I guess it's good to keep an eye out if there's any other characters that get it pulled into a dream shard with the dreamer to kind of, you know, make note to see if they have dreamer-like tendencies in the dream or you know, visions. Okay. So that's something good. That's a good theory, though. I like that one.
Yeah, and I want to just thank Tamerlan for reaching out, you know, and being interested enough to contribute. So yes. Thanks. Please keep it coming.
We love that. We love that stuff. So yeah. Guys, keep it coming. One other thing Tamerlan also tweeted out was that some of the fans refer to the in-between space as Gap of Infinity. So, you know, curious as to what other fans have given it. I think I've always called it the in-between space because I think that's how it's described in the, I guess, by the dream. Is it by the Aiel?
I'm not sure. I guess in my head when I refer to it, I'll refer to it as like the space between the worlds, or like what I really think of it as, even though this isn't like a catchphrase, is like there's a weave of the pattern, and in every weave there's a space between the threads, and that's what I picture that being.
Oh.
You know, I've got a few crochet blankets in here in my house from from family members who can do that, not for myself. And that's how I picture it. Like there's holes and there's space in between the threads and between the weave and the warp, or however you say that. And that's where they travel, in between the dreams. And from there, they can travel to any world, right? So it's like I don't know. That's how I picture it.
Yeah, the space between the threads of the pattern.
Yeah.
Good stuff. We love that stuff.
Jen, you have any thoughts on that?
What, the space in between?
No, yeah, like, do you ever, like, think... you ever in your idle like, moments, like a... Jen, think of it?
It's like you're talking about the space with, like, each dream is like looks like a star.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. I picture it like... do you ever see Wreck-It Ralph?
Yeah.
You know when he's, like... King Candy is like floating in the space where all the like code for the game is, and he can like move stuff around. I kind of like that.
Okay.
I like it.
Works for me.
All right. So our next dream is in chapter 14, The Stag and the Lion. So I'm going to take this one. So this is in Barlan. This is after they get to Barlan and they're staying at The Stag and the Lion. Rand has a dream. I'm going to warn you guys, I highlighted a lot in this, so I'm going to be reading a lot. So there's a lot of great stuff in this dream. So,
all right. Is this going to be in high chant, Joe? Or
I am not versed in high chant.
Okay.
I'm sorry about that. This is going to be in Joe chant.
All right.
Okay. So the stone hallway was dim and shadowy and empty except for Rand. He could not tell where the light came from, what little there was of it. The gray walls were bare of candles or lamps, nothing at all to account for the faint glow that seemed to be just there. So that is our characteristic of Teleran Riad that we went over last time, that the light that seems to come from nowhere.
Right.
So I wanted to point that out. So I skipped down to further down. One wall opened into a series of arches onto a gray stone balcony, and beyond that was a sky such as he had never seen. Striated clouds in blacks and grays, reds and oranges streamed by as if storm winds drove them, weaving and interweaving endlessly. No one could ever have seen a sky like that. It could not exist. So again, this is something that we also see as kind of a characteristic of the Teleran Riad, is that strange sky. So this balcony, this is going to get into a description of that we see a few times in the series. We're going to see again actually in this book, of kind of like Balzamon's or Ishamael's kind of favorite location.
It's so his party spot.
It is. There's a lot of, I think a lot of the Dark Friend meetings also, and the Forsaken meetings take place here. We're going to see the description over and over again. So he pulled his eyes away from the balcony, but the rest of the room was no better. Odd curves and peculiar angles, as if the chamber had been melted almost haphazardly out of the stone, and columns that seemed to grow out of the gray floor. Flames roared on the hearth like a forge fire with the bellows pumping, but gave no heat. Strange oval stones made the fireplace. They just looked like stones, wet slick despite the fire. When he looked straight at them, but when he glimpsed them from the corner of his eye, they seemed to be faces instead. The faces of men and women writhing in anguish, screaming silently. A single mirror hung on the wall, but that was not ordinary at all. When he looked into it, he saw only a blur where his reflection should have been. Everything else in the room was shown true, but not him. Which is kind of interesting. I always think of that as like a characteristic of like typical dreams. Like when you have a dream, certain things are like words. If you ever like had a dream where you're reading a sign, like it's always blurry. You can never read. Right. So I thought that was interesting. Something that, I don't know, just kind of taken, I think, from real life.
Yeah. Now that it is explained in like chapter 40 something or other, in chapter 42, it is explained as to like why that happens in part. But we'll get to that when we get to chapter 42.
We will. Continuing on, a man stood in front of the fireplace. He had not noticed the man when he first came in. If he had not known it was impossible, he would have said no one had been there until he actually looked at the man. Dressed in dark clothes of a fine cut, he seemed in the prime of his maturity, and Rand supposed women would have found him good looking. So this is, I think, our first description, right? We get of Ishamael?
Yeah.
Once more we meet face to face, the man said, just for an instant. His mouth and eyes became openings into endless caverns of flame. So this is so cool. I'm curious as to if they're going to do this in the show, the description of the eyes and mouth with caverns of flame.
I don't even, like, I don't know if they're going to do that, because I don't know how you make that.
Maybe they'll do it for like a split second at the end or something when he's really mad.
I'd be a little disappointed if they didn't have that, but I mean, I could understand it.
What if it wasn't an endless cavern of flame? What was it, like a small hideaway of
cavern?
Yeah, a small closed off, like a mini cave of flame.
Like a match light of flame?
No, there's a lot of flame, but just not an endless cavern of it. Like, you know, it's a small cavern.
Okay, yeah, I could see them doing that. I'm just picturing like where the eyeballs and the inside of the mouth is. You're just seeing flame coming out of it.
Yeah, I'm picturing.
It could be very corny.
I'm picturing like lamp, but you know, regular fire instead of blue fire.
Okay, yeah, all right, I see that. I could see that. Okay, going down, skipping down a little further. This is Rand saying, "This is a dream," he said as he straightened. Behind him, he heard the click of a door closing. It's some kind of nightmare. He shut his eyes, thinking about waking up. Skipping down further, he opened his eyes again. The room was still as it had been, the balcony, the sky, the man by the fireplace. Is it a dream? The man said. Does it matter? Skipping further down, Rand asks, what do you want? He demanded. Who are you? Flames rose in the man's eyes and mouth. Rand thought he could hear them roar. Some call me Balzamon. Are you the one? Balzamon said suddenly. You cannot hide it from me forever. You cannot even hide yourself from me, not on the highest mountain or in the deepest cave. I know you down to the smallest hair. Skipping down a little further. Are you expecting glory? Balzamon said. Power? Did they tell you the eye of the world would serve you? What glory or power is there for a puppet? The strings that move you have been centuries weaving. Your father was chosen by the White Tower like a stallion roped and led to his business. Your mother was no more than a brood mare to their plans, and those plans lead to your death. So there's a lot right there I just want to kind of talk about. So this is our first mention, I think, of the Eye of the World.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So we've got our first title reference.
Yay.
And this is where we see the continuation of Balzamon's game of trying to paint the White Tower as trying to use him, which they kind of are, but not in the way that Balzamon's saying, although some people from the tower probably are. And here we get some just flat out lies.
Yeah.
Your father was chosen by the White Tower and your mother was no more than a broodmare to their plans, which is totally untrue, as we will come to learn.
Right, and
he lied?
I think everything...
That's why they call him the father of lies.
Right. Everything that he says is a lie, right? So he's telling him, you know, or lies mixed with enough truth just to be believable, right? So he's telling him there's nowhere that he can run, there's nowhere that he can hide, because he knows him down to, like, the deepest level, except he doesn't know. He doesn't even know if he's the one that he's looking for,
right?
That's true.
Right. So,
and we're going to find out later that the other boys have the same dream. So I imagine he's saying the same things to them.
Exactly. Twisting them all and making them really, and something that plays out throughout the entire series, making them all very, very distrustful of the Aes Sedai.
Yeah, yeah. Rand defends his father, and Balzamon continues on. The Amyrlin seat will use you until you are consumed, just as Davian was used, and Urien Stonebow, and Guar Amalassin, and Rowland Darkspain, just as Loghain is being used. All right, so I got to stop there again. He continues on talking about how the Aes Sedai are going to use him, and he starts mentioning false dragons.
Yep.
Although Rand doesn't know these names, except for Loghain, I think, is the only name he does know.
Right.
So he's just kind of... So that's the first kind of... What's the word? I don't know. I can't think of the word. But that's the first time we hear about some of these other false dragons, but we don't know who they are right now.
No, I think that, you know... I think an astute reader may have an idea, but yeah, you don't know who the other people are.
Do we even know the idea of false dragons at this point?
You know, I don't really remember. Loghain is one, and you know that there have been others.
Okay. All right. So continuing down, Rand starts talking back. You are bound in Shai'ul Ghul, you and all the Forsaken, bound by the Creator until the end of time. Balzamon says, "Fool, I have never been bound," which is actually true, because Ishmael was never bound. Or where he was, but was he at the very edge?
He's bound in a weird way, so that basically I think he reappears for like 20 years every like couple of hundred years. And like,
that's right.
It's like an odd pattern, but like every 100 years or 200 years or whatever, he shows up for like 20 years. He can like affect the world. So
yeah, I'm going to read some of that too, because we get some great history lessons. He continues on. "I stood at Luz Theron Kinslayer's shoulder when he did the deed that named him. It was I who told him to kill his wife and his children and all his blood and every living person who loved him or whom he loved. It was I who gave them the moment of sanity to know what he had done." So that's from the prologue.
Mm-hmm.
So we now know that whoever's talk, Balzamon, is the same person as Elon. I don't remember the last name, but
more and something. But like, I think that Balzamon is one. He's bug shit crazy, right?
Of course.
I think that he is in this speech conflating himself and Triton, Dark One. I think that he's taking credit for. I don't think that he did that. I think that the Dark One did that. Right,
I think, through
the taint, but I think he's basically taking credit because he's trying to give the impression that he is the Dark One.
Yeah, he's definitely doing that because until later on in the series, you don't realize that he's not the Dark One. Because,
right.
I mean, even Rand thinks he killed the Dark One.
Right.
So you're supposed to think that it is the Dark One.
Yes.
Yes, three times. Well, he defeats him three times.
Yeah, well, two times he thinks that he killed the Dark One. Third time he knows, I think.
So he actually kills him. Well, he thinks he defeats him four times. if we want to count Moradin in there too. All right. So continuing on, this is where we get some great history lesson. And I assume this is, I think, all true. So I'll just read this part. 1,000 years. He's talking about Luz Theron. 1,000 years later, I sent the Trollocs ravening south, and for 3 centuries they savaged the world. So this is a reference to the Trolloc Wars. I whispered in Otto Hawkwing's ear. And the length and breadth of the lands of Aes Sedai died. I whispered again, and the High King sent his armies across the Arith Ocean, across the World Sea, and sealed 2 dooms. The doom of his dream of one land and one people, and a doom yet to come. At his deathbed I was there when his counselors told him only Aes Sedai could save his life. I spoke, and he ordered his counselors to the stake. I spoke, and the High King's last words were to cry that Tar Valon must be destroyed. So this is all true. Yeah. From the history that we know, is that he was responsible for the Trollocs. He was the one who did cause Arthur Hawkwing to split his kingdom and sail across the ocean, mm-hmm. which winds up becoming the Seanchan Empire.
Right. And ruins, like, it's not stated here, but like you find this out over the course of the series, right? 1,000 years later, when the Trolloc Wars hit, there was a time of peace and there was a time of the kingdoms working together that was demolished by the Trolloc Wars, when all the kingdoms were decimated and then had to reform.
Yeah, the Covenant of the Ten Nations.
Right? And then again, yeah. Arthur Hawkwing ruled the continent. And had he not been thwarted against the Aes Sedai, had he not split, you know, his main heir with half of his armies and sent them across the sea, there was a very strong chance that that would regain stability over time, right? That would have maintained. Yeah. And obviously that didn't happen, and the after he died, his empire fell apart into the nations eventually that currently exist.
Yeah. Sowing his evil again.
Right.
Balzamon is known to do.
I think Balzamon's purpose there is to not have a stable society, right? To not have something that is used to peace and prosperity and stability and growth. He wants to constantly knock it down again, knock it down again, knock it down again, so that there isn't anyone or anything that could really fight back when the next turn of the wheel comes.
Yeah, divide and conquer. Yep. So he continues on, you will serve me or you will dance on Aes Sedai strings until you die, and then you will be mine. The dead belong to me. No, Rand muttered. This is a dream. It's a dream. Balzamon says, do you think you are safe from me in your dreams? There's a goblet that I skipped about before, but the goblet is now gone from the table where it had been, crouched a large rat, blinking at the light, sniffing the air warily. Balzamon crooked his finger, and with a squeak, the rat arched its back, forepaws lifting into the air while it balanced awkwardly on its hind feet. The finger curved more, and the rat toppled over. Scrabbling frantically, pawing at nothing, squealing shrilly, its back bending. With a sharp snap, like the breaking of a twig, the rat trembled violently and was still, lying bent, almost double. Rand kind of tries to fight back with words, pretty weakly, and Balzamon says, yeah, go to the White Tower and see what happens. Rand again says, this is a dream. Rand said, panting, it's a dream and I'm going to wake up. Will you? Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the man's finger move to point at him. Will you indeed? The finger crooked and Rand screamed as he arched backwards, every muscle in his body forcing him further. Will you ever wake again? And that's the end of the dream. Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information in that dream. You know, we kind of broke it down already, but there's pretty good information, and we're going to kind of see some similarities between the dreams coming up, as with this one. Does anyone have anything else they want to add to this dream?
No, but... No, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that was a lot of stuff in there. So we have the next one is not really a dream. This is more of the aftermath of this dream.
Yeah.
I know, Tom, you wanted to kind of go through that part.
Yeah, so that's when you... I think this is the first time you realize that they're all having the same dreams, because like Rand wakes up, he wants to talk to Matt, he wants to talk to Perrin about it. He has a hard time like going through Barrowland, which is where they are at this point, finding them. He finally does, and they talk to Tom because they want to talk to somebody. And they feel like that talking to Moraine might be a bad idea, because they feel like if she finds out that the Dark One is in their dreams, that she may take action against them. They're already kind of afraid of her. So when they mentioned the names of that are mentioned, right, and then there's, again, this is more evidence that they're all having the same dream, because they, Matt and Rand work together to kind of give Tom this information. Tom doesn't outright say that they're all false dragons, but he makes it very kind of clear. So he goes, but who were they? Rand said. Men, Tom murmured. Men who shook the pillars of heaven and rocked the world on its foundations. He shook his head. It doesn't matter. Forget about them. They are dust now. Were they used like he said? Man asked. And killed? You might say the White Tower killed them. You might say that. Tom's mouth tightened momentarily, then shook his head again. But used? No, I cannot see that. The light knows the Emerald Sea. There's enough plots going, but I can't see that. So even Matt, even Tom, who is through personal experience has reason to kind of distrust and dislike the Aes Sedai, can't go so far as to say that he believes that false dragons are puppets. But he does advise them to not tell Moraine about the dreams, which is advice that they take. So, I mean, it's kind of an interesting dynamic here. I think in the fact that you have Moraine, you know, going back to kind of like the things, you have Moraine and Tom Merlin, who are two both Merlin-esque figures to kind of guide our Arthurian heroes. But they're very much at odds, and they're very much giving different advice. And Tom's advice is probably not good. but you know, he's been burned by life too, and he doesn't know whether he trusts Moraine or not, or what her motivations actually are. And he does know that if she feels like they're, you know, if she feels like they're male channelers and they're that kind of a threat, like other false dragons may have been, then she'll probably gentle them and they'll probably die. And he doesn't want that on his conscience. So
yeah,
he's saying, you know, just don't say anything about it and hopefully it kind of go away, which is advice that I always take in my own life whenever I have problems.
Well, no, it makes sense because, like you said, the experience he has with his nephew, he wants to, because he doesn't know. Tom thinks that one of these boys could probably channel.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want the same thing to happen to one of these boys as it happened to his nephew. The two other things before that I kind of noted when I was looking through it is the conversation between the cook and the innkeeper, Master Fitch, yeah, about the cat. They're arguing over the cat and he's yelling at her about her cat. And you find out that there was over a dozen rats left in the inn with backs broken.
Right.
Which is a callback to what, you know, Balzamon did in the dream.
Just makes me think, okay, did Balzamon like practice a few times before he called them in?
I don't know.
He really wanted to do three, you know? But I guess he was just like, all right, well, F it. I'm just going to make sure that this looks as cool as possible. Where should I put them on the table?
So that's kind of like mentioned that the cat's, she says that's a good cat. It's not like Siri, who's the name of the cat, to leave his handiwork behind. And over a dozen seems like a lot. And the other thing I noticed, too, is that when Matt, I guess, is telling Tom about his dream, Rand notices that there were differences. So he doesn't know if it's just the way they remembered it or maybe each dream was a little different. But the major part of the dreams was the same.
Right. I mean, I always attributed the differences to, you know, Matt's going to react differently to what Balzamon's saying than Rand is, and Perrin would do the same eventually. As well. So like those differences were kind of played out because Balzamon's not a dream. He's a real person that's interacting with them, right?
Yeah. So when we talked about this last week when we were discussing whether the dreams happened at the same time, and they happened the same night, but they clearly didn't happen exactly the same time because this is like a dream shard or in Teleran Riyadh, there's no way Balzamon could be at two places at the same time. But as we know, time travels differently. So it literally could have only been a couple of minutes. And I guess the responses of the boys kind of shapes the different,
right,
you know, maybe responses of Balzamon. So the dream probably was slightly different.
Right.
Just because of the interactions. Mm-hmm. All right. Oh, that was another deep. That was a good dream. the reactions to the dreams are just as good as the dreams.
Right. There's also one other bit that I like to say. They've never heard of the Eye of the World, right?
No.
So they asked Tom if he knows what that is, and he's like kind of surprised. He's like, so he says, it's a legend that Cleveland said solely, maybe as big of a legend as the Horned of Valyr, at least up in the borderlands. Up there, young men go hunting the Eye of the World the way the young men from Ilion hunt the horn. Maybe a legend, right? So like, and I think that's kind of important because, like, the Eye of the World is, like, really never mentioned again, right? But it's supposed to be, like, a very, very, you know, they do try and give it a lot of weight here. And I know, like, it's kind of odd because there's nothing like that ever again, Right. And even in like the whole mythology of Randland, like that there is like this traveling place of safety and the eye of the world moves around inside of it. And like it's kind of an odd kind of a thing. But he does try to say like this is like he tries to really layer how important it is. And at least Tom knows of it and seems to not know whether he believes it's real or not. So I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. Well, right, because no one actually seen the Eye of the World. That's just all stories.
Well,
because it's right, the Eye of the World's supposed to present itself at the right place at the right time,
right, only
when it's needed most.
Needed most. And never. Yeah, and if you've seen it once, you can never go back.
Yeah, and it's similar to Kalimdor in the fact that it was something left from the Age of Legends to aid in fighting the Dark One.
Right.
But as what Kalimdor is, you know, known, it's in one place and everybody knows where it is, the Eye of the World is not.
And the Eye of the World doesn't appear in the Prophecy of the Dragon, the Corinthian cycle. It's not there. Nobody knows what the Eye of the World is supposed to be used for, right? The Kalimdor is there, and even though it's part of, like, you know, it's very up to interpretation as to how it, like, what it is, what it means, and whatever, whatever, like, there's nothing about that. So, like, I do think they do address it at one point later in the books that, like, it may have had, like, a purpose that they just didn't use it for that may, like, screw them later on. But it doesn't, obviously. But I think that's interesting. And there really is nothing exactly like it, I feel. So, anyway.
No, it's like a video game one-use thing.
Right.
Once you use it, it's gone and it's never going to come back.
Right, right.
But doesn't Moraine just kind of say, like, well, I really needed to see it again?
Right.
I feel like she gives, like,
no, you're right.
Lame...
I'm sorry, you
she
are
sees...
right.
Well, she...
Go ahead,
no, they keep saying that you can only see it once, but she's kind of just like, well, I'm going to try anyway.
Yeah,
and then she kind of explains to him, like, yes. I really needed it. And then they kind of, like,
right. She's like, well, it's the end, it's the end of the world, so yeah. You can't have a greater need than that. Like, it's kind of like... she reveals it at the end.
But they're implying...
Sorry.
But she's seen it before. She's been to the Eye of the World before.
She's been to the Eye of the World before. Her and Len have both been there.
I forgot about that.
It shouldn't even have come. Yeah. It shouldn't even have, like, come to her at all. No, I felt like it was kind of like a lame way. Whatever her explanation... You know, I guess if she says the end of the world, that's not really that lame. But
I think...
They were so adamant that, like, you can only see it once. And then he was kind of like,
all
right.
Here's my question. So she saw the Green Man before... But did she actually see the eye? Because isn't the eye in, like, it's not, like, right there, right? You go to the Green Man's area.
To bring them,
and then
he
brings them into, like, a separate, like, they walk up steps or down steps into, like, a cave, right?
I don't think she's ever seen the eye.
Maybe she's never been inside.
I don't think she's seen the Green Man because, you know, she's spoken to him before.
Right. And she knows, like, it's, like, deep in the Blight where they found her, like, over the mountains and wherever else. So, like, the impression that I got was just, like, sometime in the past, her and Lan were just really far in the Blight and they were screwed. And then the Green Man saved them and, like, allowed them to, like, get to wherever they need, you know, a place of safety. But, like,
but is seeing the Green Man also something
that's
that
it? You only see him once. You only get to that spot once. Everyone gets one, and that's it. And so I always felt like the reveal that she's already been there is supposed to be, like, one last bit of, like, the deck is stacked against our heroes. Like, they're looking for something that they can't even get to, except that they do, you know, because otherwise the book is over.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah. So the Green Man known as Somesta, he's the last living Nim from the Age of Legends guarding the Eye of the World and the Blight, blah, 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 blah. We know he dies.
Was that like a champ?
I'm just on the wiki looking up some, see if there's any information. Yeah. So when Moraine explains how she managed to find him twice, Somesta wisely says, "Then it has come again. The memory remains whole." And then blah 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 blah.
So yeah, he gives some indication that, like, the fact that anyone found him twice is a sign that the end times are coming, and him. Like, when they're there, his entire time, he's like, okay, well, I'm going to be dead soon, right? This is all ending, right? So, like, he knows almost immediately, like, okay, well, this is it. And, like, he treats it accordingly. And, like, he actually is like, okay, I'm going to go set some stuff up. You guys look at this pool.
So that's not even a prophecy, too. You would think that's one of the prophecies where, like, when the Green Man has been found twice.
No.
You know, it's a sign of the end of time.
So, like, the Aes Sedai who made the Eye made it for a reason. Put him there for a reason.
Yeah.
Charged him with a reason. We never know what that reason is. And I think that's interesting. You know, in a series where a lot of the mysteries really do get explained at the end, even if not fully, at least, you know, so like you never really like, is this what it was supposed to be used for? Or was it supposed to be used for just to give the dragon his first like power boost?
I think it's used. Well, it was made because of the taints, right?
Right.
So they wanted to have a last bit of Sidene that wasn't tainted. And to be, because I think they knew
they put
that when they sealed the boar, the dark one, that he was going, it wasn't going to last forever.
Right. But like they put a seal of the dragon at the bottom of the pool. They put the dragon's banner, right? The Horn of Valera is there.
And the,
right.
Right,
they,
right.
That's true,
all yeah. these things are there, right? And you can only find them if you use the side. Like it feels like there was a very particular purpose for it, a very particular purpose. And you just never know if
yeah.
the purpose that we used it for is the purpose that it was intended for. It worked out all right, you know, eventually, but...
Yeah.
But I feel like if you didn't go there, you wouldn't need it.
Well,
like, to use it for what he... You know what I mean?
I think you needed to find the horn, though, and the banner, though.
Oh, the horn, and yeah, I guess.
And there was also right. a seal, one of the Dark One's seal, the Dark One's prison yep. was also in that broken one. Was it broken, yep. right, at that time? Yeah. So I think that needed to happen because that's just part of the pattern that he needed that banner. They needed the horn, even though there's nothing, I think they mentioned many times and there's no link to the last battle and the Horn of Valyr. No one, there's never any prophecies or any, no one ever finds any proof. I think even in the Great Hunt, Moraine's doing research to try to find out if the Horn of Valyr is tied to the last battle, but can't find anything.
Yeah. I mean, it comes in lots of handy.
Lots yes. of handy.
Some people might say.
Lots of handy.
Lots of handy.
Just for your listeners there, that's me making fun of a friend of ours. That's not, I understand it's not an actual phrase.
Oh, who says that?
So.
I wouldn't
say. I'm not going to so name. Far.
Okay, I'm not going
to name. I'm going to name.
Okay.
Names.
Yeah, let's not get into that. All right. So I think we're going to be making a part three of this because we've been talking for a while about this and we're about halfway through. So I think it's time to wrap it up.
All right.
We could talk probably for 10 hours about these dreams yeah. and about the Teleren Riad, but we need to cut it somewhere. So let's end it here. I want to thank Tamerlan for tweeting at us with his theory. That was a great tweet for us and a great question and theory. If anyone here who's listening doesn't know the Theoryland website, it's a great website.
Yes.
There's a lot of great theories and crazy theories on there. It's like Wikipedia where you could just go down the rabbit hole and spend hours and hours reading some of the theories on that site. So if you haven't been to that site, I recommend going there.
Yeah, I recommend it too. Like if you have... Assuming you've read all the books, but if you have friends who are reading them for the first time, it's a great kind of read along as you go through to kind of relive the theorizing that we all did when the books were first being published.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to congratulate ourselves. We have surpassed 100 Twitter followers the other day. Woo us! Yes, so that's great. Thanks everyone for following us and those who are listening. We really appreciate it. We really, you know, you guys obviously were doing this for not just for ourselves, but for the fans, because we know people love to talk about it and listen about the Wheel of Time. So thanks everyone for following us on Twitter, on Instagram. And I'm putting out a call to action.
Ooh.
I'm putting out a call to action to anyone listening to this podcast. What I want you to do is I want you to recommend this podcast to one of your friends. And I want you to put it on Twitter and mention us in the tweet. And then if you do that, we will thank you on our next episode.
Oh, okay.
So I'm giving everyone some homework to do. All right.
All right.
So you guys can listen to us on anywhere you listen to normal podcasts. Rate us, review us, like us, follow us, subscribe to us. We're on Twitter at Aran Talk. That's A-R-A-N Talk. We're on Facebook. We are on Instagram at @talk_Aran, @talk_Riad. Send us some pictures of your cats and dogs and pets and gerbils and
what?
Whatnot.
Joe,
yeah, I don't know anything. We like pictures.
What are you doing with those photos?
Nothing.
Yeah. We also like if you guys, you know, we love the Wheel of Time art, stuff like that. You guys wanted to
Those? And music. Yes. Oh God, we love the Wheel of Time theme music. So, you know, post that. I love retweeting and reposting music and art. So yeah, continue to do that. You could see Tom on Audio Dungeon on Wednesdays. Tom, you want to just give a quick...
We broadcast live 8:30 Eastern Standard Time every Wednesday on Facebook. Again, you can find us at theaudiodungeon.com, on YouTube, on Facebook. It's great. It's a hour and a half to 2 hours of Dungeons & Dragons action, preceded by a couple of fun games, one of which is a mystery that I write. And
Tom. Wait a second, Tom. No one who reads The Wheel of Time plays Dungeons & Dragons, right?
Yeah, there's probably not a lot of overlap there. But, yeah, so check that out. You can see what at least I look like. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Check it out. Or if you're bored another day, you can always go back later on and watch the videos.
Right. You guys are on YouTube, right?
You're on YouTube. Yep.
So you can watch all the episodes on YouTube that you've missed. You guys are up to your second season now,
yeah,
right?
We're doing it's doing well. So check it out.
All right. Okay. So thanks everyone again for listening. We'll continue next episode with part 3 of Teleran Riyadh. You'll hear us next time.